Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I am Josh and I am joined by Bo, also known as History Bro, who of course does epochs every Sunday, the day after this will go up, no doubt. So what we are going to be talking about today is what makes a good leader. And obviously everyone has their opinions about this. And I think it's particularly pertinent because there is kind of a view that's becoming more and more popular that people are more apathetic towards politics because there is a lack of virtuous leadership. Sure, we've had characters who are somewhat anomalous, but you might be able to say that, generally speaking, leadership as a whole is on the decline, if you will, in that there aren't as many good leaders as we might think of, say, 100 years ago or during World War II. Do you think that's necessarily fair? I mean, that is obviously a bit of a subjective thing.
Yeah, it's really difficult to say. I think maybe nowadays the processes that get people to the top of the political sphere, in the West anyway, it weeds out sort of extremely strong, fair-minded people, and you're left with, well, George Bush Jr. sprung to mind. Someone that is just not worthy of being in that top seat. But nonetheless, because the way systems are set up, you end up having to pick between Trump and Hillary. I mean, I don't despise Trump, but come on, Trump or Hillary Clinton. So yeah, we end up with someone like Boris taking over from Theresa May after someone like Gordon Brown. Yeah, they're not leaders in the old school sense, are they?
No.
But we live in different times, you know. I think that just reflects the world we live in the West anyway.
I imagine so. I mean, certainly our views about things would have been more in line with the people who we might venerate in the past than modern leaders, that's for sure. So there is a certain element of that. But I think that there's more of an element of we're going to rule by kind of committee. We're going to put it to opinion polls. There's a lot more of, there's a lot more malleability, I think, in people's beliefs. They're more willing to yield the majority, which I suppose in some cases might actually be good, but in others maybe not. But nevertheless,
just thinking, like someone like Gordon Brown, for example, has played the political game very well. Most people didn't like him, like didn't despise him, but just see him as just a career politician, a weird slimy guy, like white with no personality, no charisma whatsoever, like just an empty bag. I thought, well, you can't do worse than that. And then you get Theresa May, who in my opinion was even worse. There's one line where Churchill said, I can't remember which prime minister it was from the 20s or 30s, but he said an empty taxi pulled up in front of Parliament and the prime minister got out. I can't remember who's being very rude about there, but I feel that about someone like Gordon Brown or Theresa May. They're just a nothing. They're not a leader in the old school sense, but we'll get into that. I'll let you...
Yeah, so I'm not just going to focus necessarily on political leadership either, but leadership as an abstract kind of concept, if you will, because a lot of the psychological research, which I'm going to get into first, before we get into some of the historic leaders, people who are highly esteemed as good leaders, and we're going to then try and tease out what makes them a good leader, what potentially doesn't make them a good leader, once we've established some of the criteria in which the psychology has established a good leader might need. However, I will preface the actual psychology side of things in that it's not necessarily a particularly scientific area of psychology. So it's not a case of we've carried out lots of experiments, because I think partly due to the subjective nature. Who really gets to define what a good leader is, what leadership is? It's an abstract concept, and therefore it's difficult to measure. And therefore it's kind of been approached more from the business side of things. And I think there's been a lot of money put into it from private interests into the research, which I think shapes a lot of the direction of the studies. They're talking about business leaders. They're not talking about political leaders. Right. It's all very much centered on how to run a business. However, you would think that there's a lot of similarity between what makes a good leader in a business and what makes a good leader in politics, at least in you're dealing with people, aren't you? That's the foundational psychological components. It's not necessarily the day-to-day work that they do, but their approach to dealing with others and their subordinates that makes them good. And that's what it's trying to look at, I think.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, quite possibly, probably. Mm-hmm. I do feel like that in history you've got examples of people that were leaders in different capacities, mm-hmm. and that they do better or worse under different ones. For example, just one example springs to mind, that George Washington was extremely good at running an army. Very, very good at that. But was uncomfortable with running a nation. And so, of course, he brought the same qualities to it. Mm-hmm. And some were good and some weren't. So, and nowadays, whenever you pick up a book about leadership or something, it's talking about business, isn't it?
It often is, yeah. But then I suppose that's one of the few avenues where it's still relevant. We don't particularly live in as martial a society as we used to. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the only place where people really encounter leaders is in their workplace a lot of the time. So I think that's part of the reason why it's got such a focus. But I don't necessarily think that it's going to shape the underlying factors that dictate what makes a good leader. And even if it's framed in that way, I'm going to try and tease it out to make it a bit more applicable to other areas. So
I was just going to say, you can have leadership in all sorts of things, right? The leadership mm-hmm. within a household, the leadership of a school or something. Yeah. It could be play out in all sorts of different ways. I mean, mm-hmm. one of my first jobs was at the Institute of Education, and there was the London Leadership Centre. It was a whole centre of sort of ex-heads of school, headmasters, headmistresses, running programmes to make the senior leadership teams within schools perform better. In all sorts of different ways, it's sort of important, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I'll let you get on with the psychology side of it.
So the first thing I wanted to bring up is Goleman's 6 leadership styles. And I'm bringing this up not because I think it's necessarily a comprehensive or accurate set of things, but it's something tangible that we can really kind of sink our teeth into, because a lot of the psychological literature is pretty disparate. It takes very different approaches, and it's difficult to make heads or tails of it, because there's been interest in there, but it's been very very much focused on application rather than the abstract concept. So whereas you might have a different area of psychology, like visual perception, where we know all of the intricacies of the brain areas that it's processed, how our perception is affected, what are some of the bugs in our perception. We've got all these different research papers focusing on all the different psychological aspects of it, whereas in the leadership literature, it's more focused on more or less what gets good results, which which is kind of a level of abstraction closer to practical considerations, isn't it? It's not so much what are the things dictating the success, it's just what does success look like, and maybe how can we trace back what might make that up. So of Goleman's 6 leadership styles, one of the essential assumptions is that there is a construct known as emotional intelligence, which should be seen similar to something like general intelligence or IQ, something along those lines. And as we'll get into later on, there's lots of skepticism about the concept of emotional intelligence, which there's quite a good article which is written by a university professor, which basically summarizes my own position better than I probably could myself. But however, the assumption is also based on evidence that effective leaders consider the emotional needs of others, which I think is probably a fair assumption to make, that they consider how the people they're leading feel, and that means that they're a better leader. That seems uncontroversial to, I think, most people.
I suppose so.
For example, you might think of Alexander when he's conquered much of the known world to the Greeks, and then his soldiers are somewhat dissatisfied, and he's just like, yes, I know, it's been difficult. Mm. And he's appealing to their emotions with a certain amount of understanding, although I would argue that he's still trying to push his own self-interest, right? But he at least understands where they're coming from when they're just like, yes, we want to kind of go home, we're kind of bored of this. But
yeah, I mean, just to pause on that episode just for a moment, they would cross the Hyphasis into the Indus Valley, in what they called India, it's mm-hmm. modern-day Pakistan. And it's not the first time they'd said, we want to go home, we want to stop mm-hmm. going east. And in the end, they said to him, or according to Arian, this is off the top of my head, they said to him, we'd rather be executed by you for insubordination than go any further. And so it was a real line in the sand moment. It wasn't like, we don't want to do it anymore, but we will mm-hmm. if you really insist. It was, no.
And so, I didn't realise it was quite so stark.
Yeah, yeah. But there's other examples when the men didn't want to follow Caesar, Julius mm-hmm. Caesar.
Yeah, and there he, are a few examples, well, yeah.
Alexander just sulked after that. He threw a tantrum and sulked for days.
That's certainly not the behaviour of a good leader, is it? Sulking.
No, yeah. And there was a blinking, he expected the men to come to him and say, sorry, we'll carry on, and they didn't. Whereas Caesar sort of did a different type of guilt trip, sort of wept in front of the men, asking for their, for them to be sympathetic to his mm-hmm. career or something. And it worked, or we're told it worked. So, yeah, different ways of emotional intelligence, what you might call man management. Mm-hmm. I was, I don't know if I ever mentioned this, but I'm a referee, or I was anymore. I'm not, you have to keep applying for it. But I used to be a referee, a football referee, refed quite a few games, refed tons of five-a-side. And a lot of that is about emotional intelligence, mm-hmm. like man management. When you see someone like on the brink of starting a fight or just throwing their toys out of the mm-hmm. pram, whatever you want to say. And other times you do have to sort of read the person, read the situation.
Yeah.
Because if you're not doing that, things mm-hmm. can go awry quite quickly. And that's just reffing a five-a-side match, say, about running a business or a school mm-hmm. or a company or a nation or something. I mean,
yeah, well,
it's going to be important, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. There is some debate about what this actual thing is, because we can obviously tell that there's something separate between kind of your intellectual or analytical intelligence, like your IQ measure, and actually having sociability and social skills, because you can have people that are incredibly smart. You might look at people like the kind of savants at the extreme end.
Yeah, like a genius savant.
Yeah, like
they can't hold a conversation, really.
Exactly, yeah. Right. They might be able to recite thousands of digits of pi or read two books at the same time, but you try and have a chat with them, and that might be an extreme example, but it's epitomising a trend which I think follows down in all the different spectrums and possibilities, that you can be relatively good at one and not necessarily the other. And I think there's a certain amount of separation. However, I think there's also a certain amount of crossover as well. Like someone who's generally more intelligent, analytically, say, is slightly more likely to be more intelligent emotionally as well. I think that there might be some research to back that up as well, which I'll get onto later.
Okay.
So Goleman obviously doesn't take a particularly psychological
approach.
Sorry,
who is this Goleman? A psychologist? A famous psychologist?
He was a emotional intelligence researcher, but he's more like, he published his research in a business journal. So it's basically worth looking at it from that perspective. He's a relatively famous researcher, though. I think he's known in many psychological circles, mainly with derision. But I'll get onto that in a second.
All right.
So he's taken a more practical approach, focusing on what emotional intelligence looks like, rather than identifying its underlying causes or suggesting that suggests that to be emotionally intelligent, you must be competent with self-awareness, self-regulation, motivation, empathy, and with some other social skills, which is not really controversial, I don't think. I think that's pretty much how most people would break it down. Of course, this isn't necessarily a scientific breakdown of emotional intelligence, because there's already dispute about whether this as a construct actually exists or not, whether you could call it something else, because Is it a form of intelligence? Is it an innate ability? I think to a certain extent, you could argue that there's some innate, it's like an innate ceiling there. For example, if someone is autistic, then they can't actually have the ability to properly empathize with people in an instinctual way. They have to learn almost intellectually to compensate for that deficit. So you can't just say it's an intelligence, because intelligence implies that it's something that can be learnt, when there's a very definitive ceiling on that. Although, of course, intelligence as well has a genetic component to it.
Well, there's that thing where I think it might have been Dr. Peterson talking about it, but I listened to somebody not too long ago. They're talking about how when you interact with someone, assuming you haven't got autism or Asperger's or something that prevents you from being able to do it, without even trying, you're constantly reading every little muscle in their face, the intonation in their voice, every tiny little thing, and you're both doing it to each other. I suppose the ability to not do that, or the inability to do that, is sort of quite a profound disability, really. Well, you don't realise that someone's getting really annoyed, or you don't, you don't realise that all sorts of things. It can be quite devastating to your sort of interpersonal relationships with people, can't it? I mean,
well, to kind of steel man that point, I suppose. When I was doing my master's degree, we actually did research on face perception. We designed a novel experiment where we created faces that were like composite faces of lots of different facial features, and used lots of different kinds and tried to counterbalance it so there's nothing unique about it. But we would remove certain features and get people to read emotions. And I think it kind of vindicates the point that the eyes are very important, because sometimes you could add the eyes of a different emotion on another one and it changes the entire character, even if, for example, they're perhaps the lines around the nose and the mouth indicated one emotion, people would naturally look towards the eyes, which is why when you're talking to someone, you maintain eye contact. And I think it's part of that emotional recognition, as well as the fact that it's probably important in a more primitive sense, because if you're following where other people are looking, well, then you're basically able to read their intentions, because you're able to see, okay, well, they're looking at, I don't know, they're looking at their laptop, maybe they're thinking about writing something or something along those lines, where you get an insight into where your attention is directed as well.
Have you ever seen like two people, probably when they're a bit drunk, but two people having a conversation? You can tell one person's getting really, really wound up, like really badly wound up, like they might start throwing punches, kind of wound up, and the other person's just not reading that. It's just not seeing it, you know. Well, they don't care, maybe, and you're like, oh God, you can just see it happening. Or I think maybe the opposite of that. I've been talking to people and they're saying something which I don't agree with, and I haven't even consciously done anything, but I must have maybe very subtly raised an eyebrow or very subtly flared my nostrils or something. And they've obviously seen that, and I haven't really said, well, I haven't said anything. I've barely moved a muscle, but they've read it and they react to it straight away. They're like, oh, no, let me explain myself. And like, all I've done is sort of just, you know, hardly anything really.
Or people who are particularly attentive can immediately tell when something's up. Like if the kind of warmth of the social interaction isn't reciprocated, especially if you have a pre-established like knowledge of the other person, then you're immediately able to say, okay, well, this person's not happy with what I'm saying. Like, I sometimes don't even need to look at someone's face. I can read their body language and tell, okay, well, they're a bit annoyed. Like, there's lots of other tells beyond just the face as well. But anyway, that's a bit of a tangent. So these leadership styles focus on different combinations of the competencies described by Goleman, which, just to reiterate, are self-awareness, self-regulation, motivation, empathy, and some other social skills. And each one lends itself well to specific scenarios, or at least Goleman argues that, dependent on the emotional needs of those being led. The six styles described are affiliative, authoritative, coaching, coercive, diplomatic, and pace setting. I think in some of them, the clue is in the name a little bit there, but I've written a little summary. This is taken from my university days, where I actually had to write about this. So this is in my own words. And I'm just going to list them off, one through six, in the same order. So the affiliative Affiliative leadership style prioritizes the emotional needs of subordinates, seeking to reduce the chance of conflict and increase morale. The approach is good for increasing motivation, improving cohesion and trust. It is not, however, very useful in giving direction.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.